We are in part two of Family Life, and I want to welcome all of you who are here, and of course, all of you watching online. And if you're watching online right now, I just want to say I'm glad that you're watching. But you need to come and sit with us here sometime. There's just something that you kind of miss out on by not being here in the room, but I'm glad you're watching. Before I jump into today's content, I just want to remind you again that we have sermon notes in our mobile app that you can follow along with each and every week. If you don't have our church's mobile app, just go to your app store and search for Church App Tithely, Church App Tithely. Download that, and then within that app, you can switch it to Cedar Point Church, Cedar Point Church Nashville. But all of the verses I go through are always in the app notes. There's places in there where you can write down your own notes. And there's always questions at the end of those notes as well to get you thinking a little bit more about this message. And then you can also email the notes to yourself or maybe to your mother-in-law or to your boss. I mean, whoever may need it, right? So make sure you check that out. Studies show that we remember things more when we take down notes. Now, where we left off last week, we're in part two, but where we left off last week is that when it comes to family, there is this tension that all of us feel. And it's the tension between what's real and God's ideal, right? Between what's real and what's God's ideal. What's real is the fact that maybe you're going through a divorce. Right, what's real is maybe that you're in your second marriage and it isn't going all that well. Right, what's real is maybe that you're newlyweds and it's not as easy as you thought it was going to be. What's real is that you've got children, or maybe you're trying to have children, or your children aren't behaving, or maybe you have a prodigal child, or your husband won't come to church with you, or your wife won't come to church with you. Right, what's real is that all of our families will always fall short when it comes to God's ideal. So I don't know what real is for you, but real compared to God's ideal, there's often this tension. And so because there's this tension, our culture wants to get rid of the tension. So regardless of how dysfunctional your family is or how much you're struggling in your marriage, in our culture, there's something that says, hey, all right, it's okay. Right? It's okay. Just relax. You know, that is normal. In fact, we live in a culture that really wants to normalize everything so that we don't feel bad about anything. I mean, this is the culture that gives trophies to a kid or to teams who didn't do anything, right? And having four kids myself, I don't know who came up with that, right? Even kids, they understand that is meaningless, right? They just throw the trophies away. It's not a trophy if everybody gets one. But in our culture, we don't want anybody to feel bad. So when people start feeling bad about their situations, we say things like, it's okay. It's okay. Everybody, right? Everybody. But there's something inside of us, especially for those of us who are parents, who know that there is a real tension. Because if you can tell me my family is dysfunctional or that it's normal to be dysfunctional, and you can tell me, hey, everybody has trouble and get divorced, and you can tell me this is just the way it is. But when you think about your kids, right, and when some of you think about your grandkids, in spite of what's real, suddenly our mind shifts to what's ideal because you want better for your kids than you had growing up. And again, we're forced to face the fact that there really is this tension between sometimes what we experience and what we're told is normal. And yet there's just enough sense of an ideal or a shadow or maybe even a reflection to where we know this tension, it's just not going to go away, regardless of what our culture or our experience tells us. And then Jesus comes along, right? And Jesus makes it painfully clear that, yes, there is a tension between what's real and God's ideal. And when Jesus showed up, he took ideal and he jacked it up to beyond recognition, right? Beyond what anybody could even do. And he came along and he said, hey, you thought you knew what was ideal? Let me raise the bar. And yet, at the same time, let you know that for those of you who failed to live up to the standard, that there is forgiveness and there's grace. And Jesus made the tension even more intense. As we said last week, that Jesus taught and pointed toward an ideal, right, that we should all strive for. And yet, he refused to condemn those who fell short. That he taught and he pointed toward an ideal in every single area of life. He said, you thought it was this, but it's actually this. Right, you've heard it said that it's this, but it's actually this. And people said, well, Jesus, how could you ever live up to that kind of ideal? And he said, I want you to live with the tension and to know that when you face the fact and realize that your family will never be ideal, that your kids are never going to be exactly what you wanted them to be, that your first marriage isn't going to make it, I don't want you to let go and lose sight of the ideal in light of what's real. I want you to live with the tension. And yet knowing that God's grace is sufficient for you wherever you are. But you dare not lose sight of either side of the equation, because if you do, you lose something significant. So that's the tension or the context for this entire series. As we talk about things that seem so ideal and you think, Darren, it's too late for me. Right? My family will never be that way. That's the tension. Right? And that's the question for you and the question for me as Jesus followers. And again, not all of us are Jesus followers. I understand that. Some of us are still trying to figure that out. I'm so glad you're here. Because what we're going to talk about today, you can do this whether you're a Jesus follower or not. But for those of us who have decided we're going to follow Jesus, he doesn't give us an option. Right? We have been called to live with the tension between what's real and God's ideal. That we have been called to be ambassadors and proclaimers of the grace of God to people who will never, ever, ever be able to live out the ideal, just like most of us won't be able to. And yet, at the same time, somehow keep our eyes on and point people toward and direct our children and our grandchildren toward God's ideal. So last week we said that in the Old Testament there are almost no good examples of family, right? In fact, there are a lot of bad examples. And really, there are no good examples in the New Testament either. Right? All we have in the New Testament are some teachings about family and what family is supposed to do. So last week we summarized the entire New Testament with this list. Right? And here it is. Husbands, love your wives and be considerate. Wives, submit to your husbands. Children, obey your parents. Fathers, don't exasperate your children. Right? That's pretty much the whole thing right there. That's God's ideal for family. You know, love my wife perfectly. Yeah, right. Right? Submit to my husband. Have you met my husband? Right? Hey, obey your parents. My parents haven't had a thought since like 1981. Are you kidding me? Obey my parents? Don't exasperate your children. I mean, come on. Have you met my kids? They exasperate me. And yet, there's this ideal, right, that we are to shoot for. Right? This is what a Christian family is supposed to look like. And yet, as soon as we look at this list, we're all like, fail, 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 right? So what do? Do we just decide that is ridiculous? Nobody could ever live up to that? Let's just normalize what we're currently doing? And Jesus says, I'm not going to give you that option. Right? I understand what's real, and I understand what's ideal, and I want you to learn to live with that tension. Now, today, all right, just for fun, I thought we would go ahead and tackle the most difficult one on this list. So I want you to look at this list, and I want you to think to yourself, what is the most politically incorrect, I can't believe it's in there, nobody likes that verse in the Bible, especially women, right? Which one of these would you guess? Yeah, exactly, right? Now, let me tell you why this is so important. And if you're not a Christian or a Bible person, you love this, because everybody in our culture is always misquoting this verse, and they just make fun of this verse all the time. But this is an extremely important teaching in Scripture, because this is actually a specific application to women of a principle that was given to everyone. And that's the part that a lot of times people don't understand. All right, this is a specific application for women of a teaching or a principle that was given to everyone. All right, and here's exactly how Paul said it in Ephesians 5. He said, "Wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands as you do to the Lord." Now, ladies, you need to know, whenever a man would bring this verse up as it relates to his wife, and they say, well, doesn't the Scriptures teach, and doesn't it say in the Bible, I always say to them, what is that first word in that verse? And if they don't know, have them look it up. And eventually they say, wives. And I say, yeah, Paul was speaking to wives. He wasn't talking to you. Right? There's a lot of verses that start with husband. Why don't you pay attention to the ones that are directed to you, and let your wife pay attention to the ones that are directed to her? All right? So ladies, I've got your back. Now, let me tell you, though, why this is so important. All right, here's what happens. See, Jesus had all this general teaching about, you know, the ultimate value is love, and everything has to do with love. Whole laws summed up in love your neighbor as yourself and love the Lord with all your heart. That love was the driving value in the ministry of Jesus. All right, what does love require of me? All right, you should ask yourself that question every single day. All right, what does love require of me? Am I going to demand my own way, or am I going to ask myself, what does love require of me? So Paul and Peter come along afterwards, and they look at these new Christian ecclesias and these Christian or these gatherings of Christians, and there are families and there are parents and there's our children, and there's just all these normal issues going on. And they're beginning to ask, okay, how do we take the teachings of Jesus and how do we apply that to a family? Right? It had never been done before. Right? There had never been an application of love Jesus taught ever in history. right? I mean, people talked about love, and it's not like he invented love, but the whole idea that everything should be driven through this question, right? What does love require of me? How am I to love my neighbor as myself? I mean, this was just so brand new back then. To us, old-fashioned. But in the first century, it was brand new to them. So Peter and Paul come along, and they say, what does this look like in a family? Right? That's where their teaching comes from. And so Paul comes along, and he decides to take the central teaching of Jesus and apply it to every area of a family. And it just so happens that this is how it's stated as it relates to wives. This is verse 22 of chapter 5. Right? Verse 21 actually gives us the overarching principle to which we are all accountable. Right? And this is just then one single application of it. So here's what Ephesians 5, verse 21 says. Right? Submit, same word, submit to who? To one another, yeah. Right? Submit to one another out of reverence for who? Christ. For Christ. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Right? In other words, all of you Jesus followers, right? All of you church people, all of you people who are trying to figure out, you know, what does this look like in a family, including church family? He says, let me give you one big overarching principle, and then I'm going to apply it. Everybody is to submit to everybody in your family, which is this, right? It's mutual submission. Mutual submission is the idea. Everybody is to submit to everybody in the family. And then he said, let me tell you what this looks like. All right, wives, here's what you're supposed to do. Husbands, here's what you're supposed to do. Children, here's what you're supposed to do. And fathers, here's what you're supposed to do. And he basically just applies it. And the verse, wives, submit yourselves to your husbands, is basically an application of an overarching principle that says all of us are to submit to everyone else. And did you see what he says there? He said, out of reverence for Christ. Right? In other words, we're not to submit ourselves to each other and our family out of reverence for each other. Because let's face it, each other is not always worth submitting to, is each other, right? In other words, I'm supposed to submit to the members of my family, not because they are worth submitting to, but because I'm doing it out of reverence for Christ. Now, this is so, so powerful. And I'm telling you, this is life-changing if this becomes central in your family. And this is what a Christian families are supposed to do. This is what the church family is supposed to do. Right? This should be the hallmark, the driving force in every Christian family. And again, it's not going to be ideal. Right? There's always going to be what's real and what's ideal and this gap of us striving toward it and wrestling with this tension. But this is the North Star. Right, the principle of mutual submission, which means I'm going to leverage my power and I'm going to use my assets and I'm going to manage my time for your benefit, whether I'm the father, the mother, the sister, the brother, the aunt, the grandmother, or the grandfather. Right? I'm going to look for ways to help pick up your burden out of reverence for Christ, because guess what Jesus did for you? Right? He picked up your burden of your sin. And he leveraged his power and his resources. He leveraged everything he had, all of his authority, all of his position. He leveraged it all for the sake of us. He put us first. He put aside his comfort and convenience for us. He died for your sin so that you wouldn't have to die for your sin. And so Peter and Paul and the other New Testament writers are just, they're so overwhelmed by this extraordinary grace and mercy and this whole idea that Jesus would lay aside his power for the sake of other people. And they remember that day in the upper room, right? When the gospel writer tells us that in that moment, Jesus recognized that the Father had given him all power and all authority. And it's one of the most dramatic scenes in the entire New Testament, right? That Jesus realizes that all power and authority that has been given to him. And the very next thing he does, the writer says, is he gets up, he takes off his outer garment, he wraps a towel around his waist, and he begins to wash his disciples' feet. And they were so wigged out by the idea that their master, their Lord, their rabbi would wash their feet. And they're, no, all right, wait, we should be washing your feet. And Jesus says, I am setting for you an example. That the more power you have, the more authority you have, it just means that you become a better servant of those around you. And so Paul and Peter are thinking, okay, what does this look like in a family? And Paul comes up with this idea. I've got it. Right? Just as Jesus, our Lord, submitted himself to those under his authority. So everyone in a family should submit themselves to one another out of reverence, not for the people in the family, but out of reverence for what Christ did for us. And he introduces us to this powerful principle, the principle of mutual submission. Now, here's just my opinion, okay? I think whether it's a family, a business, a neighborhood, you know, a group of friends, this is the most principle that there is, right? Mutual submission. That when a group of people come together and they say, basically, I'm here for you, right? And my influence, my power, my status, my wealth, it is all available for you. And everybody in the group does that. That is the most powerful thing you will ever see. And it was introduced to us by Jesus. And so Paul comes along and he says, when it comes to families living out the gospel, right, here's what it looks like. Submit yourselves to one another out of reverence for Christ. It kind of blows this up into something powerful and wonderful is just one simple question. Right? And this is the question that will change everything if you begin to ask it. Right, here's the question. What can I do to help? What can I do to help? Right, how can I loan to you who I am, what I have, what I have access to for your benefit? What can I do to help? So let's practice this, all right? Even if you're watching online, all right? I want to count to three, and all of us are going to say this together, right? Or where we're at. Ready? One, two, three. What can I do to help? All right, one more time. Ready? One, two, three. What can I do to help? That is a game changer, right? I'm telling you, if everybody in your family at least once a day would go to everybody else in the family and ask them, what can I do to help? Your family changes. Now, kids, right? Listen, high school, middle school students, I'm telling you, your parents might pick themselves up off the floor if you ask them this question. Right? And don't wait 2 or 3 weeks later until your parents have forgotten this message. I mean, just go ahead and do it. Right? Even this afternoon, even though they know that you're just saying it because I told you to, it will still have an emotional impact, right? You come home from school and you walk into the kitchen, hey, mom, dad, before I get busy, what could I do to help? And they will be shocked and they won't have an answer. Right? You can go up to your room and you still get credit for it. They'll be down in the kitchen shaking like, okay, what just happened? What happened? I'm telling you, kids, all right, you start asking this question, you might get control of your entire family. Right? If you really want to earn some brownie points, you do it in front of their friends. Like if they're having a party or maybe life group at their house, you walk into the kitchen and you say, hey, excuse me, mom, dad, is there anything I can do to help? They'll look at you like, no. I mean, everything's fine. And then you go upstairs and you get credit and all their friends are going to teach us. Right, teach us. Teach us how to parent. Right, we know nothing of parenting. Right, you think I'm exaggerating. I'm not. Right, because when we were kids, I didn't want to do anything to help anybody. I mean, it's all about me, right? Haven't you figured that out yet? Somebody asked me what to do. I was like, whatever. Like, forget it. That is so dumb. That is so dumb. Now, parents, right? Parents, regardless of what stage you're maybe at in the whole parenting thing. As parents, we're always, you know, trying to instruct. We're, you know, looking for teachable moments. We're always correcting. So I want to challenge you, every parent, at least once a day, to look your kids in the eye and just say to them, hey, honey, is there anything I do to help? I mean, is there anything I do? I mean, just in general, anything I do to help. You know, mom, I'm going to. Is there anything I can do to help? Dad, I'm going to. Is there anything I can do to help? Do you know what this does? Right? This keeps conversations from always going negative. Because if you're not careful, especially if you work outside of the home, life gets busy, right? And you get to the end of the day and your kids are already kind of in their mode and they get busy and it's just all about getting them to bed, right? But to pause and to say, hey, I'm here for you. Is there anything I can do to help? Most of the time, they're just going to say no, right? Now, ladies, right, wives, girlfriends, fiancés, women, this is a powerful question to a man. And you know what we're going to say most of the time, right? Most of us men are just going to go, no, right? You can't help me. But you know what this says? This says, I'm aware of your burden. Right? I'm aware of what you're doing. I'm aware of the responsibility that you carry. Now, I'm not trying to interfere, but is there anything I could do to help? I mean, is there anything I could do? Is there any way that I could loan to you some of my extra time? Is there anything I can do to take maybe something off of your plate so that you are more free to do what God has called you to do within our family? What could I do to help? And then men, I'll be honest with you. I rarely, if ever, get this right. And honestly, we're scared of this question if you're a married man. Right? This question scares us. But it is a powerful, powerful question. Because in many of our homes, you're sort of the leader, or at least you should be. Right? You think you're better, you're smarter than your wife. We know we're not smarter than our wives. But why in the world men, God put men in charge? I don't know, right? But he did, right? But if women were in charge, our world would be such a better place. There would be less wars, less people in prison. Why we're in charge, we'll ask God when we get to heaven one day. But because of that whole weird dynamic, man, I'm telling you, again, this is a powerful question. On your way out in the morning, it's like, honey, before I take off for the day, is there anything I could do to help you today? Because some of our wives, men, are afraid to ask us for help. Because when they do, they immediately feel, right, before we even open up our mouths, as soon as they begin to ask us to pick something up or to go somewhere or on your way home, could you maybe stop by, right, they feel the resistance because they know you're going to respond negatively because most of the time we do. And you know, when you ask that, what could I do to help, it opens the door to let them know that, hey, I know that my deal is not as important as your deal. Right, we're in this family. I'm willing to loan to you who I am. And I don't expect you to always leverage your time for me. Honey, is there anything I do to help? Well, what could I do to help? She may fall on the floor. Right? If you ask her this question before you leave today, we have a brand new AED out in that foyer if you need to shock her back to life. Right? I'm just saying, this is a powerful question. This is the bridge to mutual submission. So one last time, all right, ready? 1, 2, 3. What could I do to help? Now, I want to talk about the barrier to this, right? And the barrier is fear, right? That's why we don't ask this question. It's fear, right? And here's what we're afraid of, and maybe men more than women, I don't know. Kids definitely, all right, kids are scared to death to ask this question because they know if they ask this question, they're going to end up out mowing the yard, doing dishes or laundry because it's like, what could I do to help? Well, yeah, now that you ask, I got a whole list for you. But we're afraid, right? We are afraid to say, what can I do to help? Because somebody may take advantage of us, right? They may actually have something for us to do that we don't want to do, right? That suddenly we're not going to be first anymore. Right? We're afraid that they're actually going to have an answer to the question, what can I do to help? That's why Ephesians 5:21 is so important. Again, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Because there is a sense in which God looked at this big old messed up world and Jesus stepped in and said, Father, what could I do to help? And then the Father said, you don't want to know. No, really, what could I do to help? Well, it's going to cost you your life. I'll do that. And you're going to have to go down there. You're going to have to be number two. Or you're going to have to get in line behind every single person who has ever lived. And you're going to have to give your life in order to help them. Okay, I'll do that. And so Paul says, right, Paul who spent time with the men who watched Jesus die on a cross. And he says to us in Romans 12:1, out of reverence for Jesus, I want you to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice to everyone around you, especially your family, even your church family. And yes, they may take advantage of it. And yes, you may have to be number two. And yes, you may not get to get everything done that you wanted to get done, but welcome to becoming a follower of Christ, right? Out of reverence and gratitude for the fact of what Jesus did for you, you get to do that as well to your family. The good news is that 99.99% of the time, it's not going to cost you your life. Just a little time, a little effort, maybe a little bit of money, maybe a little bit of inconvenience for you, because you hate putting that IKEA furniture together. But that box has been sitting there, and that box has been sitting there for 6 months, and you asked her, hey, what can I do to help? And she walks over, grabs that box, and sets it in front of you, and you're like, ugh. Because you know there's going to be pieces missing in the thing, but that's just what you do, right? We fear this. But here's the deal. If you refuse to ask, or at least in this conversation, you are like Dorothy walking around with those ruby red slippers trying to figure out how to get back to Kansas. It's like, I want to go home, I want to go home, I want to go home. Well, do you know you had the potential and the power to go home the entire time? Really? Yeah. Because do you know what it takes to have a great family? It's families who have said, I am willing to leverage all of me for us. That's a great family. Now, I mean, can you imagine how you would feel if your children or your husband or your mother-in-law who lives with you or your father-in-law who lives with you would come to you every single day and ask you, what could I do to help? You know what that would do for your heart and your soul, and you have the same potential to do that for them. And the only reason you don't is because we're selfish, which means that you will never be happy with your family ever. Because your whole approach to family will be, if I could just get everybody to do what I want them to do, then I'll be happy. No, you won't be happy. You'll be in charge, but you will never, ever be happy. Happiness does not equate to getting everybody to do everything that you want them to do. That's not happiness. Happiness, especially in a family, is mutual submission. Men, we struggle with this the most. And some of your wives can't get you to do anything, and they've never exactly said it like this, but they're afraid to ask you because they don't want to hear the blah, 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 and they have no choice but to go throughout their entire life tiptoeing around your ego. And you don't have the time to do anything for them because you're working and you're more important and you want to go do what you want to do. And so your wives, they lean in and they lean in and they lean in and they lean in until they fall over. And then it's like, well, what's wrong? Well, you don't get happy by controlling the people around you. You get happy when you loan yourself to those around you, just like Jesus did for you. Right? The key to a great family, the key to great relationships is mutual submission. Now, question. All right, so does this mean that nobody is an authority and nobody makes the decisions and we all just kind of go around, no, you first, no, you first, no, you first, no, you first. No, you have the biggest piece of chicken. No, you can have the biggest piece of chicken. And the chicken's cold and mom gets mad. Of course. Right? This principle has nothing to do with authority, whether or not somebody is in charge. It has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with what we do with our authority. So dads, if you feel like you're called to be the head of the home, which he has called you to be the head of the home, then be the head of the home. Right? The same way that Jesus is the head of the church, who gave himself for everybody for the sake of the church. You see, that the model is Jesus. And I don't think ever in the history of the world since the coming of Christ, nobody has ever argued, well, Jesus can't be the head of the church because he gave his life away. No, we would say that Jesus is the head of the church because he gave his life away. All right, so men, if this is your deal, you don't have to worry about being an authority. Right, you don't have to worry about decisions and taking responsibility and manning up and all that stuff that we have to do. That's all fine. Right? It has nothing to do with giving up authority. It has everything to do with learning out the power that comes with your authority, just like Jesus did. Because the more power you have, Jesus says, the better servant you should be. Right? You should ask this question more than anybody else. What could I do to help? Now, if you're not a Jesus person, not a Christian, that's okay, right? We're glad you're here. And we don't think we're better than you or anything like that. But here's the good news. You can try this for free. Right? You can take out all the Jesus part and the B-I-B-L-E and all of that. You can just go home today and you can try that. You might want to wait a few days so that people don't think you're becoming a Jesus follower or anything like that, right? We get that. But do you know what would happen if you start to do this? All right, it's going to be great. If everybody in your family starts asking, what could I do to help, you can have a better family without being a Christian family. So we are giving it to you for free, but just remember, hey, where you got it, right? We gave it to you. But if you are a Christian, if you're a follower of Jesus, right, you don't have any choice. And why would we want any choice? Right? You see, for while we were still helpless, remember this verse? For while we were still helpless. Right, do you know what that means? It means while we needed what? While we needed help, right? At the right time, right? In the nick of time. It's not, well, I'll see if I could work you in. You know, I don't know. I'm busy. I'll let you know. I mean, could you imagine if Jesus said, oops, I was too late. You know, died in your sin. Sorry, I was busy. No. At the right time. And again, this is so important. While we needed help, according to our timeline, not God's, Christ died for the ungodly. So where do we get off thinking that this is optional? I mean, this isn't all, yeah, I ought to do that someday. No. This should be the trademark of my family and yours. Right? It's never going to be ideal, and I'm always going to fall short, and you're always going to fall short, and we're always going to lean towards being selfish, and your kids are always going to think the world revolves around them. I get that. But the ideal that we should shoot for in our homes is that we constantly ask the question, what could I do to help? Because that's what Jesus did for us. And do you know who the ungodly are? The ungodly are the people who look for loopholes. People look for a way out. People who have ignored God their entire lives, even though they grew up knowing that Jesus is the Son. Right, that's who Jesus died for. The undeserving, the ungodly, the ungrateful. He died for you, and he died for me. Again, it's like God said, well, what could I do to help? And Jesus said, wow, this is going to cost me. And Paul and Peter are like, imagine what this would look like in a family. If the members of a family modeled what God did through Christ, and they extended that to the other members of their family. It wouldn't be the strong survive, and it wouldn't be, well, dad's the boss, and everybody's got to do what dad says. Right? Peter said, no. Right? It would be like when Jesus recognized that all authority had been given to him, and yet he washed our feet. Imagine people using their time, and imagine people using their money, their resources, for the sake of everybody else in the family. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Wives, you submit to your husbands. Husbands, you love your wives like Christ loved the church. Children, you obey your parents, and parents and fathers, don't exasperate your children. Right? That's what it looks like when everybody comes together committed to mutual submission. What could I do to help? I mean, wow. Right? Well, what could I do to help? Even if you don't mean it, try it. Right? And tell your kids, your wife, your husband, it's like, all right, what can I do to help? There, I got it out. It's like, dad, that's awesome. That's amazing. Do one more time. No. It's like, all right, I just want you to know that I love you the same way that Jesus loves us. What can I do to help? All right, last thing, and then we're done, I promise. When you feel like that's when you need to ask it the most. All right, think about that. When you feel like asking it the least, that's when you should ask it the most. Let me pray for you. Heavenly Father, now I know that this is kind of a tough topic, an emotional topic maybe for some of us. And some of us maybe sitting here thinking about what our family could have been like growing up. If only someone would have shared this years ago. But today is a new day. The decisions we make from this point forward shape our futures. So, Lord, I pray for our kids, our middle schoolers, our high schoolers, that they would grab a hold of this idea and embrace it so that they would grow up to be godly men and women, husbands and wives, fathers and mothers who wouldn't struggle like some of us have had to struggle. And I pray, Lord, that you would just give each of us wisdom, right? Convict our hearts where we need to be convicted. And yes, we're all going to fall short. But help us, Jesus. Empower us to make the changes that we need to make. It's in Jesus' amazing name that we pray. Amen.